Now we're turning to 1 Timothy in chapter 3. And we're considering a good ambition, a good aspiration, a good desire. And the apostle at the beginning of the chapter says, "This is a true saying. If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work." Going to look at the term desire in a moment. It's used twice in the first verse, but it's actually not the same word. Two different words are used and put together. It really describes the kind of person that should be an elder or an office holder in the church. Specifically elder, but the chapter goes on to speak of a deacon. Indeed, there are only two offices in the New Testament church. Various terms in scripture are used. The term here translated in our Bibles as bishop really means an overseer. It tells us the function of a church elder. There are other terms as well that are used throughout scripture, but pretty much they are synonyms. Bishop, overseer, pastor. They're all the same people. The pastor is a teaching elder. The term here, bishop, could equally be translated an elder or an overseer. Only two offices in the church. Wherever did we get all the rest from? And certainly the notion of a bishop as someone who administratively is over many other elders and churches doesn't appear in the Bible at all. No, we don't have mitred bishops, cardinals, canons, archdeacons, etc. These came in time. These are the traditions and appointments of men. Two offices continue in the New Testament church. An elder, and an elder is distinct from a deacon in that he must have the ability to teach and to preach. The deacon, also an office in the church, well, looked after the more mundane, the practical matters and issues, though indeed they too were to be quite spiritual men. But I want to begin with this. Men, where's your ambition? Have you an ambition? Let's widen it. Christian, have you an ambition? Why does Paul begin? Look, this is a true saying. If a man desire the office of a bishop, an overseer, he desireth a good work. Why does he emphasize that this desire, this aspiration, is a good one? Surely it would seem to us that goes without saying. Well, because one of the things constantly taught throughout the scripture is that ambition, selfish ambition, is to be no part of a Christian and Christian character. That belongs to the worldling. That belongs to us in our unregenerate past. A trait of the unconverted is selfish ambition. It's about me. It's about my power, influence, or improvement, or wealth. It's something that it adds to me. Now, so that all Christians, particularly here with regards to office holders in the church, we need them. They're God's appointment. It's God's order. If everyone just abandoned ambition altogether, thinking any kind of ambition is selfish, we wouldn't have these people. So Paul points out there is such a good thing, men, as good ambition. Good aspiration. The two words I mentioned that are translated desire, though they're two different words. The first one means, where it says, if a man desire the office of a bishop, it means an external to himself. He's reaching out for something. He aspires to something. He wants this. The second desireth, where he says desireth a good work. This is not a bad thing. There is such a thing as holy ambition. And this comes from within this term. The second term for desire in the verse means a driving ambition, an intense desire. It could be translated quite literally, a lust, a desire for this office, obviously with the right motive, the glory of God, the use of a God-given talent. We're not going to mention, though this would be included in it, the calling of God to office. But part of that calling, evidence of a calling of God, is this intense desire, this wanting to serve God, wanting to contribute positively to the church, to serve the church. It's not about lording it over. It's not about promotion and standing in society and so on, or even in church society. It's about the glory of God, but it's an ambition. I want to do what I can. If God's given me an ability and a talent and a gift, I want to use it. Men, have you got an ambition? Have you an aspiration ever to have office or hold it? It's not a bad thing if your motive is the glory of God and the benefit of others. So Paul says, they that desire this office of bishop or overseer desireth a good work. Let me extend it, because that keeps it very narrow, although it's certainly the context. But let me ask you as a Christian, have you got ambitions or desires? Have they ceased? Has the zeal gone? No longer have any zeal. It's gone. Perhaps a little illustration or analogy. It's a bit like the footballer, you know, who goes out onto the pitch. And there he is in all his kit. He looks the part. He's with the team. He's actually on the pitch. 90 minutes later, when the ref blows his whistle to end the game, you approach him. What's it like as a footballer? What was the game like? I see you weren't terribly involved. You didn't seem to move very much on the pitch. In fact, I thought you were rooted to the spot. Did you kick the ball at all? Well, I would have done if it had come anywhere near me, but no, I didn't get a kick. Did you tackle anybody? What about the other team? Oh no, I didn't do that. Did you pass a ball? No, I didn't do that either. Can't recall doing that at all. That'd be nonsense, wouldn't it? What's a footballer do? He plays football. He kicks a ball. He tackles players. He tries to score goals. He passes to people on his own team. What's a Christian do? What do you do as a Christian? Any ambition? Any desire? Well, I come to all the meetings. Well, forgive me. That's the irreducible minimum. If at all possible, a Christian comes to all the meetings, that's the irreducible minimum. Is that the height of our aspiration and ambition? And for some, that may be a very healthy and good ambition. But if we've got a skill, a talent, a gift, just to come to a meeting but not participate, not contribute, what's that? Paul says, if a man desires the office, reaches out, strives for, wants to be, wants to have, he desires from within, motivated by the glory of God, by the love of Christ, by a desire to contribute to the local church and brethren in some way, impact upon a neighborhood. If that's true, he desires a good work. Where are you, Christian? Do you desire a good work? And of course, the church needs church officers. They need elders. They need deacons. Well, let's just go a little further then. I've mentioned the word desire in the first verse. Then it gets to the qualifications, doesn't it, of an elder. I'm just going to run down some of these very briefly. But a bishop then, and here, yes, it's good to desire that office of an overseer, of an elder, but there are qualifications, verse 2. And a bishop then must be blameless. And that's the very first thing that comes, reference to character. The term blameless could be translated unrebukable. Indeed, in chapter 6 and verse 14, that very term is used, and it's the same word that's translated blameless here. Only in verse 14 of chapter 6, the term unrebukable is used. It's a catch-all term, and it refers to the character of the potential candidate or the one aspiring to be an elder. He has to be free of charge from without and indeed from within. Nothing obvious, nothing that stands out as would bring rebuke or leave someone blameworthy as opposed to blameless. So you're looking for a person. You need an elder. What is he to be, first of all? Of general good character. Nothing obvious in his life. Nothing that stands out. We get into specifics, but here's the heading before we get into all the subheadings then. So a bishop must be blameless. Look next on the list, the husband of one wife. Quite literally, a one-woman man. Now, it's often thought that this is a reference to polygamy. That what Paul is saying is that an elder must have only one wife. I think it's more than that. I think this is not so much, not primarily man's marital status, but his character morally, that he must be morally pure and sexually pure. He's a one woman man. Of course he'll be married if he has such a relationship, but it's his purity. There must be the man must not be even open to the charge of a wrong relationship with another woman, a second woman. He must be a one woman man. Not just polygamy. Polygamy, by the way, at this stage and this time, wasn't so much an issue. Indeed, the Romans had actually banned the practice, though many of them would circumvent the ban one way or another. But in Roman law, polygamy was banned. No, Paul is saying the man must primarily, he must be sexually, morally pure. Is this man that has seemingly the gifts, the talents, the ability, seemingly the desire, and at least verbally articulates the right motive for wanting to be an elder, but is he known to be a bit of a philanderer? He's just a little too fond of other women's company. Not openly adulterous, but just mixes just a little bit too much that makes you have a little question mark or a little warning bell sounding. Well, you wouldn't even consider such a person. Paul says this is a man who is committed wholly, totally to one woman. There is no question, no charge could ever be led that he's interested in another woman in this manner and fashion. No, a one woman man. Next, he must be vigilant. Well, again, I'll take the two terms together because there is overlap. If you notice that following vigilant, you have the term sober. And that taken together simply means that the man must be of a sound mind. He must be clear-headed, of such a mind to be in control of his passions and pursuits and desires. It's a reference to attitude. It's not a reference to wine and alcohol when it says he must be sober. This term is the sound mind term. He must be clear in his thinking, clear in his aspirations, clear in the objectives of the church and its purpose, clear though he may lack some knowledge. He's not going to have a perfect knowledge, but he must be clear in the doctrines of the scripture. Certainly all the essentials, the deity of Christ, salvation doctrine, justification, sanctification, and so on. Church order, church practices, church offices, evangelistic, all such things. This is what a church considers if a man is being presented or a candidate before them for the eldership. Is he clear? Is he woolly in his theology? Does he come up with a theology that makes you think, I'm not so sure about that? I can see where that would lead us. I can see where that would take us. Is he clear in the kind of worship? Is he, fixed? Is he rooted? Can he be blown? Can he be moved? Does he seem to follow the latest trend or whatever? Off at a tangent, whim and fancy? Or is he solid in the scripture? Does he give you the impression this man knows his mind? It's been formulated by the scriptures and the doctrines of the word. He's got a clear grasp of what it means to hold office in the church and the direction and purpose of the church. There's no question about that. If there is, he's not fit to be an elder. No, put together, vigilant and sober. No woolly thinking. students of the word. I aspire to be an elder. I think one of the tragedies of today would seem to me that many of those that are holding an office, not necessarily that they haven't had some formal training or background, but that they don't seem to read as they used to. When we were converted, or when I was converted, it was a thing every Christian took as read. They read, they studied, they were devouring books. Seems to me you can speak to some elders in a church and they haven't the faintest idea. That's a tragedy, and that of course would disqualify them. Paul wants a man in character to be morally upright and pure, unrebukable, nothing evident and obvious in his life that people would point to and say, that man's a flawed man. He's got a bad character. But also one that is knowledgeable and clear. He is of general look, good behavior, of good behavior. All round, general good behavior. He mightn't dot the I's for you or cross the T's in everything that's important to you, to me. But is his general behavior with regards to these things, his morality, his desires, teaching, preaching, the life that you can see, commitment to the one woman in relationship, if he has one, doesn't mean necessarily he has to be married, by the way. That's one interpretation as well. It's suggested because it says he must be the husband of one wife, that he has to be married. Indeed, there's great question as to whether Paul himself was married, and many assume that he was not married. Anyway, given to hospitality comes next, and apt to teach. Notice, given to hospitality. The word that's used actually here means a lover of strangers. Given to hospitality, a lover of strangers. Two words put together. A xenophile, we would say in English. Greek word for stranger, xenos. Lover of strangers must be given to hospitality. And that's a difficult thing. It's not always easy. When it says lover of strangers, I don't think it's always the feeling and delight. It's the meeting a requirement and a necessity. I'm sure it's times against the flesh's desire where hospitality is given. And yes, it's wonderful. It's good. Christ says we'll prove it's more blessed to give than to receive. That's true. But there are times, if we're honest, you'd like to just go home and put your head down and say, I just like a quiet afternoon. Well, if you do that all the time, that wouldn't make an elder or a candidate for the eldership. An elder, Paul says, it's a requirement. It's an element in the elder that indeed they are given to hospitality, and they will show it, and they will help, and they do consider others. Hospitality for those particularly alone or who live alone. Going on from that, given to hospitality, and of course apt to teach. Not something that's required of a deacon, but most certainly required of an elder in the church, that he is apt to teach, has the ability to teach. Not just a desire, but a recognizable, a visible, if you like, ability. You've heard this man. You get the opportunity to hear him. He's preached. Has he the ability to preach, to teach? Well, of course, then you decide and you hear. If he is called of God, if he is being equipped by God, here is an evident ability. He will be apt to teach, says the apostle. He won't be one given to wine. I think the best way, and some say, well, it means, it says, not given to wine. Well, that's true. That's what it says. But I, and it's only an opinion, I think the best way to make sure you're not given to wine is not to drink wine in the first place. You're certainly not going to be given to it if you don't do it at all. It's much easier in our day to live without wine. We've got all kinds of medicines. We can't say it's just simply medicinal. Oh, we love the quotes, I think, sometimes, don't we? The, you know, what's good for you, what you can eat, what you can drink. Notice how some of the ones that are latched on to become favourites. Glass of wine's good for you, you know. Not too much, but it's good for you. They say so. The scientists tell us. Yeah, that's why I'm drinking it, really, because it's medicinal. It's good for me. If you go to certain places and certain parts, they'll tell you whiskey's good for you. Guinness is good for you. Used to sell it. That was its selling and its marketing ploy and motto, if you like, almost. Guinness is good for you. They served it in the hospitals. I asked for mine. I was only 9 at the time. I thought they were getting something. I wasn't. Well, they were. They gave it to the men at their breakfast. So it was good for you. Possibly some things in it. I'm sure you can get them elsewhere. And lots of other drinks and things. Anyway, not given to wine. So if there was someone and they had a little drink problem, certainly they'd be disqualified. If they couldn't do without their little drink, then the apostle says no, that would disqualify. Not given to wine. No striker. Well, not someone who's quick to lay hands on, goes for the throat, grasp. No, it's no striker. Doesn't fight, doesn't lift his fists, doesn't resolve arguments or difficulties, quite literally, with his hands or with his fist, or doesn't show a desire to do that at all. Not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre. And of course, that's always one of the big issues as well. Not given to money. You'll see a little further in the list, having said, not greedy of filthy lucre, you see also not covetous. Just a couple of terms on. So not greedy of filthy lucre, not covetous, not a lover of money, quite literally, not a lover of silver, the term is, not covetous. Is this man showing over an excessive or overly interested in wealth, in possessions, in things, in spending, in some things lavish, extravagant, perhaps? Well, he would be disqualifying himself as an elder if it were so. So it's not covetous, not a lover of money. And again, I think that would be evident to some, those that would work, not out of necessity, all the hours that come, but if they showed an interest in acquiring wealth, more, bigger, better, they'd be disqualified. Paul said that would be a bad trait to see in a man who wanted to be an elder in the church of the Lord. No, not such a person. And then, patient and not a brawler. And I think there from the term, having already said, no striker, when he uses the term not a brawler, I think he means verbally and not with the fists or hands. Not contentious. Not one who just strives, loves an argument, makes an excuse for one. Argumentative all the time. Not a brawler. No, says Paul, that person doesn't enhance his application or candidacy for the eldership in any way. No, he must be rather patient. Not a brawler, not covetous. Verse 4, is he a married man? Has he children? Well, what are his children like? How does he rule his own house? One that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. And indeed, this can disqualify many people. You get a person and he has all the gifts, preaching gifts, ability. Morally, he is beyond reproach. Everything seems to be in place. Then maybe you see him with the family and the children just walk all over him. The children run the home. Now, says Paul, if this man can't rule well his own house, he said, verse 5, then he can't possibly take care of the church of God. So, you see, don't look for perfect children. That would be very unfair, wouldn't it? And don't look for children that are wooden. I'd get terribly concerned if there was another extreme. And you know, you've maybe met some families and the children are so wooden. They're unnatural. They're scary. They've been so drilled, so disciplined. They'll sit, they'll hardly speak. I think that's terribly unnatural. Of course, there are extremes, aren't there? There are those who will go from that, and that is an extreme. Thankfully, extremely rare. But I think I've seen it once or twice. And you go from that to the other extreme, where a parent just sits there oblivious to these little ones tearing around all over the place, doing whatever they like with anybody else's property and so forth. And I'm thinking, well, I won't tell you what I'm thinking. I think you would be thinking similar things if you were witnessing it. Somebody get hold of him before I do. No. Balance. Children respectful to the parents. Obviously a good relationship. The children love the parent loves the children. But in natural, not in extremes. No, Paul says this man should rule well his own house. I don't think that necessarily means that they have to be converted either. Many a child is converted late in life, aren't they? But it would mean a certain, standard of behavior and good behavior, that they would be obedient to their parents, that their parents would have control. This is the man that's going to be an elder after all and take care, says Paul, in the church of God. If he can't, or doesn't know how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Verse 6, not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Well, to put a novice in a leadership capacity or in an office, certainly as an elder in a church, the Apostle Paul says that would be utter foolishness. That would be cruel in some ways. And I don't think he necessarily has in mind age. It's not their age, it's their maturity. And some young men are very mature and wouldn't be excluded. Indeed, Paul writes to Timothy, as you know, and he tells him, let no man despise your youth. So it's not simply about age, but it's a novice in the things of God. A recent convert, he may be an old person, age-wise, but he's a novice. You could have a younger person who's been a Christian from childhood, or even not so many years a Christian, but have developed and studied and done it so well and diligently, they are very mature. No, he means spiritual immaturity. Not a novice then, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Why would it be such a cruel thing to appoint a novice as an elder in a church? Because of position and pride of position and aspiring to something even greater that Satan himself, remember, an intelligent, a beautiful being, a perfect being, an angel of light, and indeed a leader, it would seem, in the hierarchy of the angels. This Lucifer, with all that he had and his creation as a perfect being, it was because of position and aspiration to power, more power beyond his status, that brought him right down, appoint a novice to the eldership. And Paul says, you effectively place him in the same position. You leave him open. And remember, Satan was created perfect. This young person, or at least novice as a Christian, is a fallen being, even if regenerate. Don't do it. Don't put them there. The temptations will be so great. No, verse 7, moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Again, similar temptation. The aspiration to higher and bigger and better. And look where I am. Look who I am. No, that'd be foolishness. And then verse 8, likewise unto deacons and so on. But I'm going to stop there. But just some things in general with regards to the eldership. But don't lose all your ambition. Don't think that all ambition is unholy ambition. Don't give up your own aspirations for a higher, better Christianity and life walking with God. No, you don't settle for the irreducible minimum. No, what talent, what ability, what gift do I have? Can I use it for the Lord? I want to. That's the motive. The right motive. The right motivation. So then it's a true saying, if a man desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good work, a good ambition.